Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Okay, everybody, we are at 723 ratings on Apple iTunes. If you could just do us all a quick favor, scroll down to the bottom of that Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars. It really helps other people find the show. As a reminder, if you leave us a 5-star rating and you ask us a question in that rating, or you screenshot and email it to realignmentpod@gmail.com, we will answer your question live on the air, which brings us to our question, Marshall. What do we have?
Yeah, speaking of which, we have Mr. Z from SoCal. I really like your guys's unique usernames that we're sort of going with. We've got Murmur922. Okay, Scotty, that one's kind of boring. Seth, not great. But Mr. Z, you have won the username of the week. Actually, that's why I actually picked out your question, because that sort of stuck out to me. So to Mr. Z's question, you continually mention using economic means to achieve conservative goals, but rarely elaborate on what exactly you mean by that. Is it a strong family-based culture? Is that the extent of conservative goals for you? To what extent does that go? Realize that may be a personal question, but I'm genuinely curious. So quick context for this question. I'm glad he brought it up. It came up in the Orin Cass episode. It actually comes out in today's episode. And I think this came up with Zed, Jelani, Andrew Yang, this recurring theme of what is the actual means of achieving conservative public policy goals? Because what this basically relates to is this debate on the right about whether libertarian small government, those sort of policies are the way you could make conservatives happy, or whether conservatives should be comfortable using the power of government to advance their means. So Sagar, what's your sort of perspective on that?
Yeah, I think all conservatism comes down to the family unit. And maybe that seems a little odd, and a lot of people do disagree with this. So when I say using economic means to achieve conservative ends, what I mean by that is incentivizing the structures in American, not just American life, in human life, which we know are beneficial to people if we look at how they live their lives. One of those is getting married. We know from 2018, which is the latest year that we have data, which was the lowest year that we have of marriage on record here in the United States. So pre-COVID, that Americans did not get married, not because they didn't want to, but because they did not have the economic means to do so. It's something you're also going to hear a lot about in our episode today with Matthew Iglesias, where he talks about how Americans say they want to have 2.5 kids on average per family and are really having around 1.7. So what does that mean? It means that the structures of our life, our economic life, are not conducive to being able to live out your core goals of happiness, which is getting married, which is having kids. I'm not saying that you have to do that, but what I want to do is create in a society where if you want to do that to your maximal end, that the government should be there to help you. That's what economic policy is all about. Commerce, markets, and all these things, they're not natural states. They're designed by us to achieve an end state, which we decide as a society is better for us. And for too long, we've decided that profits are actually more important than children and for getting married.
So something I'd actually love to hear from our more libertarian-leaning answers is your response to this dynamic, because this is one of those areas where, regardless of what you think about this issue, this is probably one where the Republican Party's actual base probably lines up more with Sagar. I think if you actually look at actual Republican voters, this is sort of a realignment thing we talk about, actual Republican voters wouldn't particularly care about the specific philosophical debates about the nature of the state and those sort of things. They would probably sort of ask, oh, great, you know, like a child credit that make it easier to raise my kid would be pretty great. Or, oh, hey, a child credit that would mean that I could stay home and not go to work to raise my child part-time. And this is something Matt actually talks about on the podcast and other appearances. A lot of people would actually like a more part-time flexible structure. This is also interesting when we're thinking about how a lot of people are working from home now. So there are always sort of different ways to sort of explore this. So I would like our libertarian listeners who sort of hear child tax credit spending as violations of conservative principles, I would like to hear, what is your case then to voters who have those priorities? If you're someone who says, hey, I wish I could stay at home, didn't have to take a gig economy job while I just had a kid, what are you offering them? Because that's something that we want to sort of push our listeners who have that sort of perspective on. It's something that there has to be a recognition that you could have your political and philosophical disagreements, but the actual ideas are really important. So
that is a perfect segue into our conversation today with Vox co-founder Matthew Iglesias. He's written a new book called 1 Billion Americans. That's the case for thinking bigger. Matt, frankly, has a lot of zany ideas. He wants America to have 1 billion people. But the predicate of the book is not so much about the population. It's about what such a population could enable America to be. And that is a geopolitical competitor to the People's Republic of China. That is a nation that believes in itself again. That is a nation that believes in investing in its family infrastructure. We could have turned this, I think, into a debate episode because there's a lot that we disagree with. But why do that? I mean, it's just so much more fun to have kind of a jovial, fun conversation with somebody who really loves America, wants to see it be doing better, and has embraced a case for thinking bigger. And if there's one thing I will commend Matt on, because there's, like I said, plenty I disagree with, he at least is not nihilistic about our past, about our current, and about what our future could actually look like. And if we're going to have a great new American century, then it's going to actually take somebody on the left to parlay with and debate with that believes that America should be great in the 21st century. What do you think, Marshall?
So this is really great because when we read the excerpt of his book that appeared in New York Magazine, it's a really interesting sort of framing. The part that caught our eye was two things. Firstly, he said, this is obviously a really stressful and not great moment in American history, but the advantage of such moments is there's a lot of energy and there's a lot of new ideas, and that's something that we really like to do on the podcast. So 100% from the start, we're aligned with Matt on that. And then the second part is he thinks a large reason why there is so much discord and disagreement in our society is the fact that there is no real big project. You know, we sort of have this listless sort of experience that everyone sort of grasps. So his point is we should assume such a new project. His project then is greatness. And that part of greatness comes through, in his view, population growth and becoming bigger. And a part that's really interesting here and where I think people should really dive deeper into is, for example, he points out that if we look at a lot of cities in the Northeast and the Midwest, Detroit, Cleveland, Toledo, Erie, Pennsylvania, Buffalo, New York, Rochester, they have like half the populations they sort of used to have. So when he says immediately people sort of question, is it possible that we could have 1 billion Americans? I say, look at our cities. They're actually depopulated. There's actually this whole huge problem we have in this country. So what I want our conservative listeners to think about, the people who are going to sort of scream at us for not saying, Matt, we can't technically admit 50 million more immigrants. What's your response to greatness? Like, what is your sort of policy view for sort of recapturing and enabling sort of competitiveness? Because that's the part that Sagar's speaking to about Matt's spirit that I found really compelling and made us want to focus more on a debate about greatness itself and actual means of accomplishing our goals. Thanks as always to Lincoln Network, the host of this podcast. We have been really excited to spend the past month plus putting out these new episodes for you guys, increasing the number, and we're excited for what we're going to do moving into the future. Speaking of which, a reminder to everyone to sign up for Reboot 2020. Lincoln's post-election conference is going to deal with a lot of these sort of issues. Sagar is going to be there. Rachel Bovard is going to be here. A lot of really interesting conversations that are going to go virtually. So Sagar, take us in.
All right, with that, let's dive in.
Matt Iglesias, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here. How's it going?
Hey, good to see you, Matt.
So you're here to discuss your new book, 1 Billion Americans, and we actually read this book because it was very interesting, and I think you sort of hyper-primed it to both trigger and interest us. But I want to reference your New York Magazine excerpt that we'll put up in the show notes here, because You basically start off in an interesting way. You talk about there's this idea that there's all this political tumult in this country, but that actual tumult has opened up a chance for new ideas, new projects. This podcast is called The Realignments. We're sort of interested in this political moment. Could you speak to this political moment and how that's sort of shaping your response to the era?
Sure. You know, it's a political moment of some ferment, some new ideas on the table. We've seen, Donald Trump very much came in from the outside of the political process. Joe Biden, by contrast, a very establishment type figure. But, you know, this is a time clearly when people can gain support in politics outside of traditional structures, in which there's a lot of interest in new ideas. But the actual, like, operation of the United States Congress is incredibly partisan, and also just not very, not that much is actually happening, right? Like, if you look at like the 4 years of Donald Trump, some people will say like, oh my God, this has been such a crazy time. And by such a crazy time, what they mean is that a lot of things happened that people got very excited about on Twitter. A pandemic happened in 2020, which is obviously a big deal as a global phenomenon, is sort of outside the American political system. But if you were to just soberly sum up like the Trump years, right, in legislative terms, you would say like, you know, a couple bills passed, like Republicans won an election and they cut taxes some.
Yeah.
Shocker.
That's, you know, I mean, it's not unimportant. I have more money than I would have had if that tax cut bill hadn't passed. Mm. That makes a difference. But like, you know, every Republican cuts taxes. There was no great like populist remaking of the universe, right? And Democrats have gotten very keyed up about Trump on a lot of dimensions. But, you know, are going with the incredibly conventional political leader. And, you know, if they win, taxes might go up. There might be a minimum wage increase. But like, I don't think, you know, there's going to be like sweeping policy transformation coming from Joe Biden, in part, you know, because of who he is. But I think less because of who he is than just because of how the political system is going these days. So to me, part of the fun of writing this book is that the core idea is so weird and sort of aspirational. And I enjoyed inhabiting the mind space of trying to think through, like, how would we triple the population? What problems would that cause? And then how could we solve those problems? And what if America just like wanted to make big changes of different kinds? Like, what kinds of changes could those be? And, you know, I'm a liberal person. Some of the ideas in this book, you know, fit very nicely in the progressive side, but a lot of it is just kind of outside those lanes. And I'm trying to think about concepts of national greatness and patriotism that I think are more associated with the right, but think them through in a way that like a person with my sensibilities and interests and knowledge does. And so, you know, it involves more openness to immigration, a more robust welfare state, some sort of traditional left ideas, some a little bit less traditional, but really just trying to think about the problems we face in a bigger, different way from this kind of like fighting over the corporate income tax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the part of the book that probably resonated with me the most. And it's like you said, it was almost designed to trigger, but in a way, I found myself relating to it quite a bit. In just in terms of a project of national greatness, whenever we might think about what that actually means, and you're right, which is there is no positive vision really being put forward by the more, not even the establishment wings, by a lot of, most of the people who are actively involved in legislating for both the Republicans and the Democrats. Can you think through what brought you to this idea of a billion Americans? And I've heard, you know, I've read part of the book, and I've heard you on a couple other podcasts. It's a lot rooted in the idea of scale and increasing returns to scale. When did you start thinking about things in that term?
So, you know, there's sort of two different routes that brought me to this book collectively. One is listening to the specific problems of different cities in America, right? So both intense housing affordability crunches in a bunch of coastal cities, but also a real lack of vibrancy and economic opportunity in, we said it was called the Midwestern cities, but a lot of them are in the Northeast, actually, just not like Acela stops. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Worcester or Springfield in Massachusetts, Rochester, Binghamton, Utica in New York. And so you go to these communities and you look at like one of them. And you say, okay, I can envision like a revitalization of Utica, right? And it always involves, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and it's going to cause people to want to come here, and companies going to open up. And what's true about all that is that, you know, opportunities follow opportunity, right? So a big challenge for a lot of these places is just that they're kind of cold. And like all else being equal, people prefer to migrate to warm places. Mm-hmm. Same time, Boston is a very prosperous, successful city. You know, a lot of growth, a lot of job opportunities. And that's, they have all these fancy universities there. There were those labs spun off, a lot of companies, some sort of computer tech, but mostly biotech, medical type things. And then because those jobs are there, people come to do the jobs and other people come to, you know, have restaurants or hair salons, or people come, they drive the buses, they build the houses that they're in, right? There's a whole economy just built around the fact that other people are there. And you can replicate that. In like one city, you could say, okay, we're going to have a new research center and it's going to be in Cleveland. And like, we should do that. That'd be great. I love Cleveland. But if you want to do it across multiple cities, right? Trump in his campaign, he painted at one point this, I think, very appealing vision of like these Rust Belt cities, like coming back, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're going to shine. But you can't do it, right? Like, mathematically, just by like putting some tariffs on things, there's needs to be actually more people. Because when Trump says like Cleveland's gonna shine again, like he's not promising to depopulate Houston, right? Like, you know, like sure. he isn't, right? He's trying to talk to people in declining areas and meet the aspirations that they have, but nobody is saying, and like, we need to undo all the growth in the Sun Belt. So you actually need more scale to do that. Then the other part of this is about China, international competition, and like, wouldn't it be better for America to clearly stay number one?
When this is something that I did not know, I mean, you understand this directionally, that these Midwestern, Northeastern Rust Belt cities have depopulated, but I didn't realize the scale of which they depopulated. So like Detroit, what has like half of its population from like sort of the 1950s. So like, that's your point about like, where are these people going to sort of come from? Like, who, if like, where is Cleveland to sort of go? So can you sort of speak to the real scale of what's happened in these cities since sort of like the height of post-Cold War industrial America?
Yeah, so, you know, people start driving cars after World War II, and basically every city loses population. And, you know, why not, right? You know, you can drive in from the suburbs. It's very natural. Some cities, though, you know, New York, Washington, D.C., kind of hit bottom at a certain point, and more people start coming in, and that's all good. Thriving metro areas. We have so many other cities, like St. Louis has lost about 60% of its population, Detroit about half. And then, you know, in the book, I rattle through lists of Philadelphia, Baltimore, Buffalo, down. Six of the top 10 cities in Ohio are below their peak population and still shrinking, right? And the big problem here is that when your city is shrinking, it tends to continue to shrink because you don't have the tax base to maintain your city services. You don't have the customers to go do other things. Your houses, they're not just affordable in the way, like, it's great. Like, my in-laws live near San Antonio, and San Antonio is affordable in a way that mm-hmm. DC or New York, where I grew up, are not. But a place like Buffalo is not just affordable. It is so cheap that the houses are worth less than it would cost to rebuild them from scratch. And that means that homeowners' sweat equity just kind of wastes away, and that landlords don't have incentives to keep up their structures, right? So a lot of people who I know read Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, which is basically about shitty landlords in Milwaukee. And it's a great book, but I think a lot of people think it's a book about landlords, but it's really a book about Milwaukee. Right? Where the particular circumstances there incentivize landlords to behave like that. Now, anyone who rents, I was a renter for years. Anyone who rents a place, you kind of hate your landlord. There's a little bit of a conflict of interest there. But like, you know, capitalism oftentimes works, right? Like, people make money by providing a worthwhile service to you, the customer. And in a healthy city, it's like that, right? You own the building, so you don't want it to be infested with rats. You want your tenant to tell you there's a problem, and then you want to fix it because the building is worth something. When you get to a place where it's just decline and decay, it's not like that. And you're just trying to squeeze whatever juice you can out of these declining assets. And so people don't want to live in cities like that. So if you do something good, you know, like you make the schools better, you know, where you help somebody with a program, then they go to school, they go to college, and then they leave. Right? Because you want to be someplace with opportunity. But that's dysfunctional, right? Like, we don't want that. We want there to be, people want there to be opportunities in their community. And they want the children growing up there to get educated and things like that. But we have a dynamic now across a large swath of the country. Like, most rural counties are losing working age people, as well as many of these Rust Belt type cities. And you can't reverse that on a national scale without a change in the trajectory of the national population. Mm-hmm.
So what strikes me most about what you're saying is kind of like the populist tale of both sides, like the right mm-hmm. and the left, and kind of like how they would internalize like a story of the last 30 or 40 years and what we would call globalization, but what we really mean is like China and kind of what's happened, along with an acceleration of a lot of different trends. Mm-hmm. The question I have is, you know, you wrote about how this has never been a better time for big ideas. Completely agree on that. But how do you have big ideas for a national project if you can't come to a consensus on what a national project is, whether there should be a national project? I mean, frankly, there's a lot of like pseudo anti-intellectualism or intellectualism out there right now about how any sort of national project itself is bad. How have you reconciled that right now?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is like, when I started working on this project, which wasn't even that long ago, I felt like this was a less prominent thing. But now I think, you know, people will look at this book and, you know, it's like red, white, and blue on the cover. And like, it's got a lot of stars. And so some people on the left are like, oh, man, I don't know. At the same time, like, you know, like, that's America, right? Like, this is a kitschy, patriotic country where, like, we'd like our 4th of July fireworks displays. Like, you look at like a Biden-Harris event and it's like, it's freaking full of flags.
I
went to Germany for their most recent federal election. It's like, there's no flags there, right? Like, it's very, you know, Germans, they have a certain amount of pride in their country and their culture, but they don't at all have that culture of patriotism. And that's due to the nature of German history, obviously.
That whole thing.
which we know about. Bad things have happened in American history, too. I think that goes without saying. At the same time, we have always made progress in America, I think, by emphasizing sort of American civic nationalism and the idea of the United States as, at least aspirationally, a shining city on a hill. And I think that any kind of politics that doesn't touch base with that is like fundamentally a dead end. Right. I mean, we have always had debates about like what the meaning of the American national mission is. And it's always good to have like books and critical inquiry about different episodes of history. But, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, or, you know, just like Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Like, these things are done by talking about, like, what's been good in American history, who our heroes are. And I do think that this kind of current vogue for, like, scouring the past to say bad things about people. So DC did this inquiry into, like, who stuff is named after, right?
Yeah, right.
And so some of it unveiled, like, genuinely bad, you know? So they'll be like, okay, so there's a library or something, a school. It's named after somebody you've never heard of. And it turns out, okay, this guy, he was, like, on the D.C. Council, and he really fought hard for segregation. So, yeah, okay, maybe we shouldn't be honoring that guy. But on the list was also Ben Franklin. So I saw that. I was like, what's up with Ben Franklin? And so it turns out that Ben Franklin, for a time, he owned two enslaved people. And that's obviously horrible. At the same time, well, why are you honoring Ben Franklin? Like, well, everybody knows why you're honoring Ben Franklin, right? He was the American minister abroad. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He wrote the funny things. I think he founded an anti-slavery society. Mm-hmm. So, like, what is the point of being like, actually, you know? So, I don't know. That is my sort of basic take on that. I don't think... leftist intellectuals are going to get anywhere with this like hermeneutics of suspicion on the United States as a country.
But this is where it gets interesting though, right? Sort of a leftist intellectuals versus, but you know, I'm sure, you know, like the critique of sort of like woke capitalism. I don't know if you sort of saw that Twitter thing. It was an image of a Lululemon like athleisure ad where they were referencing like dismantling capitalism, like in the actual ad. You really should, and it's sort of like we have to sort of stick up for our right listeners here. Our right listeners are right, cool. Like Matt's based, like Matt gets it, but like the vast majority of people on the left are ultimately comfortable with sort of like woke performative liberalism. And this is actually spread from like annoying Twitter intellectuals to the heights of corporate America, to the heights of like, you know, the university systems, to Hollywood and entertainment. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, that goes a bit, you know, beyond the scope of everything. But, you know, corporate marketing is very cynical. Right. And that has sort of always been the case. Right. After 9/11, it was like we were going to fight terrorism by going to the mall. And now we're going to fight racism by going to the mall. And, you know, whatever is in the air, like buying some new clothes is going to solve your problems. It's, you know, that's the nature of marketing. Right. And the point of politics, though, is to try to translate these sentiments, right, whatever they might be, into something that is real, right? And so to say, you know, racism is what people have been talking about, but it's like what can we do that would be helpful, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a real way. And so like I saw a paper yesterday, it was about like how much a minimum wage increase closes black-white earnings gap, right? That's not something corporate America is going to get excited about.
Yeah, right.
You know, because like they don't like paying people money, but it makes a real difference in people's lives. By the same token, you know, my book is more about like American greatness, right? So if people are in a patriotic mood, like corporate America will slap a flag on anything. Like they don't care, right? They're mm-hmm. all for it. Or they'll tell you, right? So if you talk these days to a Facebook lobbyist about anything, they'll be like, well, we got to stick it to China. We're an American company, right? And so it's like, okay, you know, so you are. But then if they're talking to the lobbyists in Europe, they're like, well, we're a global company, right?
Yeah,
we're interested. And that's, you know, it's business. There's no point in getting too mad about it. Mm. But I do want to say that, like, look, we should take competition with China seriously as a subject and not just as a, like, excuse to help out some American company that has some beef with a Chinese company. Like this TikTok thing, I think Trump is probably right on. He's gotten a lot of bipartisan support for it, I think because it's probably correct. But also like banning like a video meme app is not gonna like shit.
Right. Make America great again.
So we have to think about it, right? And like fundamentally, like why is China a big deal, right? And it's because there's so many Chinese people. It's still a pretty poor country. It's like Mexico, Bulgaria. And so because it's poor, they have a lot of opportunities for their economy to grow relatively rapidly because they're nowhere near the technological frontier. They can copy stuff. They can grab things. They've got a lot of upside. And we can't stop them from trying to fulfill that upside, but we can fulfill our own upside, right? Which is that like a lot of people want to come here. Americans say they want to have 2.5 kids per household, just like we used to. But now we're having like 1.7, right? So how do we make those things possible, right? How do we tweak immigration policy to handle people's objections to it without closing our doors to foreigners? How do we let people have the families they want to have? And then we can have a growing, thriving country that stays number one forever. And we can, you know, tell the developing world, like, by all means, go get rich. Like, two thumbs up for you, but we're going to leave you in the dust anyway.
So this is something I really want to get to in the core of the book, which I think, mm-hmm. you know, if I were to distill it down to like a sentence I was telling him, it would be like, he wants a billion Americans because he wants America to be awesome and we need to beat China because China is bad. And I mean, I sympathize with that argument. But I guess the question to me, kind of the way that you just distilled it there, is that China, despite being a, you know, like a Bulgarian average, you know, GDP per capita country, just because of its scale is willing to wield power. I mean, in a way, could we read that as we need a billion Americans just for the sake of it, even if they live like relatively mediocre, like not high quality lives, just having the scale itself is so important for national power? Because if so, I mean, most Americans would be like, yeah, but I don't want to give up my quality of life and more just because on the aggregate, we would be stronger. I want to beat China because we're, you know, we're awesome and we build big things here.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the point of the book, right? I mean, look, you write books that are good. I started looking into this subject, right? I was like, well, what would happen if we had a billion Americans, right? Mm. And if I'd convinced myself that it would be just like a really difficult, painful trade-off, I'd just go think of something else to do with my time. But I started thinking, no, like we could solve all these problems. We could solve the problems of Rust Belt decline. We could, you know... address the needs of our housing and transportation sector. We could have a stronger economy. We could be more prosperous. And now that's not to say like you want to just be completely arbitrary about it, but that there is a viable pathway here. And that's why, you know, we were talking before about the idea of national projects, right? Mm-hmm. To say like, I know open borders people. Some of my best friends are open borders people. I agree with some of the things that they say. I think they have made a lot of sound economic arguments that people kind of underestimate the value of immigration. But this is like really fundamentally not an open borders book, because I think that kind of, well, whatever attitude, like that does not make sense, right? Like this should be a project. Part of the project is having more immigrants come here, but like it should be deliberate. It should be more deliberate than our current immigration. We should be thinking about how can foreign-born people who would like to move to the United States be helpful to native-born people and our aspirations and what we want out of the world. And connecting with that vision of immigration, I quote Abraham Lincoln in his 1864 message to Congress, and he says, like, we've got to do more to encourage immigrants to come here because we're going to have to rebuild after this war. The actual details of that policy, like, I don't think you would want to emulate, but the spirit that he was operating with, which he wasn't like a contemporary progressive who's like, oh, it's so sad. We've got to help these people. We feel sad. Everything's about being sad and guilty all the time. It was like, no, like, you know, we're going to win the war, but we've got this cool Homestead Act, but like we need mm-hmm. somebody to go on the homesteads. Like we got to get some more people in here. Like let's be amazing. And that's what I'm all about.
Can you speak to sort of the balance between, because you basically have two broad policy proposals mm-hmm. here. One is make it easier for people to sort of have families, getting us up to the desired sort of, you know, birth rate, and then also increasing immigration. So adding those, what, like 600 million people, roughly, mm-hmm. what is the proportion of we're increasing the birth rate and what is the proportion of like immigrants? I think you cite 100 million people right now say they want to immigrate here. So how does that balance out?
Yeah. So, I mean, I started trying to do the math and, you know, working with spreadsheets. And of course, it gets complicated because the immigrants themselves have children, right? So it's like it's hard to give a really clean answer to it. The basic goal is to get America's population growth rate up to Canada's. If we grew as rapidly as Canada is growing for the next 80 years, we hit a billion by the year 2100. So Canada has both more immigrants relative to its population than we do and also a higher birth rate. One reason for that higher birth rate is that immigrants have more children than native-born people. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a confusing mix. Fundamentally, I don't think we know exactly what the fertility response to more family supportive policy would be. And I don't want to be like a crazy human manipulator you know, like
tinkering
people,
with.
If the response is bigger than anticipated, I don't want to be like, oh no, like stop having the babies.
1.2,
right?
Cut it off.
But also, like, if it doesn't work, right? If people go up to 2.2 kids instead of 2.4 kids, yeah. I don't think. Singapore has this like creepy campaign where there's like posters up everywhere and they're like, have more babies. And it A, doesn't work, and B, it's super weird. And I don't feel like incredibly comfortable advocating for that. I was on Tyler Cohen's show and he was like, well, maybe we should just make everybody be Mormons. And I was like, I don't know. Like, Mormons seem pretty great, but also like, I don't know what does that mean as a policy? And like, should people be more religious? Like, I don't know, you know, maybe. It seems like it's good when people have like communities and faith is a positive impact on a lot of people's lives, but we can't like make them, quote unquote. So right. We'll have to see what happens. I think if we did more to support families, people would have more children. I think if people had more children, that would change what they do, right? Like, I spend less time drunk at the bar now that I have a kid. A lot of people, they have kids, they go to church more, right? If they had more cousins, they might have more children themselves. But I don't want to, like, promise exactly what the dynamic impacts of this are going to be. Whereas at least in the short term, immigration is this, like, you know, it's like a faucet, right? You can turn it on, turn it off. And, you know, I think we should turn it on quite a bit right now, and we could turn it down if for some reason we had to.
So this is the other interesting part on this, though, which is that if we need a continuing national project of greatness over a period of 80 years, you need some level of societal cohesion. Mm-hmm. What are your prescriptions? Like, how have you thought through this? If we're going to have such a radical influence of immigration, and this is aside from the high skill, low skill. I mean, look, my parents have PhDs, like they're professors, and I was born here in this country. There are a lot of like woke young South Asians who have like internalized this narrative of like the oppressed POC and have bought into a lot of this like very elite cosmopolitan culture. How would you, I mean, so even if we were, like, say, all high skill, 100 million or something, how would we continue to have a project of national greatness when we see so much of the way that recent immigrants to this country, it's in that sector in particular, feel? And I want a particular response to this one, which is, if you talk to the real doomers, you know, like who are people on the right, they'll be like, look, 7 out of 10 of, you know, recent immigrants to this country or recent newborn Americans voted for the Democrats. Like, there, it very much feeds into this idea that it's like, oh, the only reason they're for immigration is because then they can win national elections. We'd just love to hear a response to that.
I mean, I think conservative fatalism about winning the votes of people of color has been very damaging to America. It's both,
I completely agree.
Brought like right-wing people, for one thing, it's counterproductive, right? Because like, if you decide it's hopeless, then you don't do the work. It's also created a lot of like loopy demographic triumphalism among people on the left, who will be like, well, we're just gonna like do without white people and who cares, right? No, but I mean, you know, after 2012, you like heard a lot of that, and it, you know, it didn't work politically in the long run. To me, one of the most interesting things about the 2020 race, right? Right now, you know, Biden has a healthy lead. It seems like he's gonna win. It seems like Trump is gonna lose. But Trump has, by all accounts, gained a couple points with African-American and Latin voters. And, you know, we don't know exactly what's going on there. But to the best of my knowledge, you know, talking to pollsters, talking to people, it's that the marginal working class Hispanic person, the marginal working class African-American person, the marginal working class white person are just not that different politically, right? Now, the averages are obviously different, right? Trump doing better with black voters means like get 9% instead of 6, right? Right. But it just shows it's not like undoable, right? Because, you know, so, you know, people on the left talk about, you know, intersectional issues and things like that. But an inverse of that, like, also applies, right? Which is that, you know, there are people have multiple identities. They're religious traditionalist Hispanics in the United States, like a lot of them. And they may not agree with Democrats about certain gender-related issues. And that's like, you know, a campaign theme Republicans can work with. You know, you mentioned, I was also on Razib Khan's show, where he is also interested in this, that like South Asians in particular have a lot of influence in like far left intellectual life in the current United States.
Right.
And I do not have a particular theory as to why that is. But it just goes to show that so much of current partisan politics is educational polarization, right? So South Asian Americans are an incredibly highly educated demographic, and highly educated people have really gravitated toward the left. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a little bit contrary to the like schematic of like, oh, the Democrats are like importing this like helot proletarian class that will vote for them forever. Like, actually, Trump is doing better with working class people of color. Right. And, you know, the like kids of all these doctors and engineers are getting PhDs and, you know, decolonizing our podcast and whatever else. But that just goes to show that like partisan politics is weirder than people want it to be. And there's more degrees of freedom for like political entrepreneurs. I think, to put it mildly, the current Republican Party has not been super deft at its outreach to people of color. But it's not totally ineffective, even as it's been a little bit clumsy. And I think conservatives should have a little more sort of confidence in the idea that their vision makes sense. Like, after all, like, you go to, I don't know where, you know, go to Jamaica, go to the Bahamas. There's conservative political parties in those countries, right? It's not like everybody looks around and they're like, oh, no white people here. I guess we got to just give up. Like, they're religious people. They're business owners. They're people who put more priority on upward mobility than on safety net stuff. Like, these are like conservative politics, more than any other kind of politics, actually like speaks to universal aspects of the human condition and desire for like groundedness. And the idea that you like couldn't handle that if like some more people came here from Honduras or whatever, I think is a little bit silly and weird. Whereas I think there's a real question about like, how do we want to select immigrants to come to the United States, right? Is a completely valid policy question.
Yeah.
So the part that we're not really hitting at here and will be helpful for listeners is, can you sort of outline what this a billion person, or what would an America that just was denser, I think is the correct way to put it. Mm-hmm. What would that America look like? Because I think if we were to sort of articulate the doomer, right, conservative vision for what this would sort of be, it would be that the America you're describing would basically turn into South America at its worst. So you would have sort of the wealthy urban enclaves, and then you would have like favelas where there are desperately poor people, basically like a parody version of California. I take it that's not your prescription for your vision of America. So articulate sort of the counter to that version.
Yeah, I mean, look, so I really just urge people to do the math. Like, some people are out there on Twitter like, oh, he's going to have everyone living in Mega City 1 because, you know, that's Judge Dredd for the, you know. So tripling the population, like, it sounds like a lot. It is a lot. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. But it means we would have the population density of France. So I don't know. France is probably like one of the foreign countries Americans are most familiar with. They've got vineyards there, some nice coastal towns. It's fine. We would have half the population density of Germany. We would have nothing. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is like, well, what if we had the population density of the UK? And it's like crazy. That's like 7 billion people and nobody wants to come here. There's like not enough people on the planet for America to be as dense as the UK. I've been to the UK. You know, London is similar to New York, I would say. Like, a great city if you like big cities, very expensive, a lot of affordability issues, but like really cool. And then they've got rolling hills, they got sheep. You can go up to Scotland. It's like, it's fucking empty up there, but that's like a lot of the plains in the United States, right? Like, in an interesting eyeball sense, you would never know, oh, I'm in a country that's like orders of magnitude denser than the United States of America. Which is just to say that like, the things that you like, right? Like, we will still have those things. Like, many people in this denser America will live in big cities. Many other people will live in suburbs of those big cities. Some people will live in small cities. Some people will live in rural communities. Some of the land will be national parks. Some of the land will be grazing land for ranchers. There's going to be political arguments between the ranchers and the people who want there to be more national parks. Because, like, that's what we have now, right? Like, that's just, like, how things go. But we're not, like, out of space in some objective sense, right? Like, there's just plenty of room for extra people, a little more density here and there, a little more growth here and there. Tons of our cities have shrunk. And it, what a growing America would be most different is that it would be growing. Right, pretty much any kind of community that you would go to, you would see construction activity because it would be adding people. Right now, you see that, you know, you go to San Antonio, you go to Austin, there's like cranes every place. You go to Seattle, there's a lot of visible cranes downtown because Amazon is building offices. But you walk around the suburbs and there's nothing happening because they have exclusionary zoning and you're not allowed to build anything, right? And that's what would be different, is things would look, I don't want to say like everything will be exactly like Austin, because I can't promise you taco trucks or that they would just like let homeless people have tents every place. But you know, that sense of like pervasive building and adding is what we would have.
One question I have here is on political coalitions. You know, I obviously you're a person, on, you know, more a liberal person, and I guess this might be probably more geared towards the Democratic Party. I mean, is there a realistic political coalition for this on the left? I mean, we see kind of the, you know, the realignment on the Democratic Party. We see a lot more new suburban voters who are voting Democrat who may not necessarily want, you know, or they might actually be the exact same people who voted for exclusionary zoning and really like exclusionary zoning. What does the political coalition look like for this on the left that's a ruling coalition which would be able to actually legislate and pass this through Congress?
I mean, you know, it might be a better idea for the right. I don't know, you know, what anybody's doing here, right? You know, I don't think Biden's going to run on this. I don't think Trump will either. But, you know, I think that big national projects are actually not associated with specific political coalitions, right? Hmm. There wasn't a let's win the Cold War political coalition, right, in a coalition sense. There was a consensus that we should try to win the Cold War. And then there were sub-coalitions inside that consensus who had different ideas about what that meant and what it would look like. And different parts of the winning strategy were put together by different people. Like, I think the civil rights movement in some ways was intertwined with Cold War politics, right? That there was an alliance between, you know, people who just wanted that as a demand for self-respect, for justice, certain elites who saw it was making us look bad in a third world context. And there were conservatives, you know, who opposed it, but it got done. Then as a somewhat separate post-Vietnam thing, right? Like Ronald Reagan came in with a rejection of détente, and it was a partisan project, essentially, but it was part of a larger umbrella in which there wasn't a completely universal consensus, obviously, at any point in time that we should do this, but it existed in both parties, and there was a ping pong back and forth. So I think you could easily see these ideas coming in different directions. I mean, I know in terms of your project and like the concept of realignment, there's a lot of interest among conservatives, I think, in putting some more like meat on the bones of the idea of populism, right? That like what are we actually trying to do here? I think not everything in this book, but some of the things in this book can, you know, fill that out a little bit. Some of these are just like straight up, I think, progressive ideas, but maybe a different way to talk about them that broadens the coalition a little bit outside the kind of college-educated professionals thing. Like, I want people, I want Democrats to talk more to working-class people and working-class aspirations, and I want Republicans to acknowledge the sort of inevitable diverse future of America and talk to those aspirations, right, in conservative ways, progressive ways, right, but to like engage with the reality that we are going to have a multi-ethnic working class majority for the foreseeable future in the United States, and we need to do politics that's relevant to that.
Right.
So what would be helpful, I think, too, is, as you sort of admit, right, like this book is a thought exercise. It's interesting, but you don't literally think there's going to be a political program implemented in the next 4 years. What is like your projection for this country's sort of state in 2050 if we continue with basically the status quo, right? So a combination of like hyperpolarization, declining birth rates, weird fits and starts. So like Biden maybe wins, but then that goes for 8 years and sort of like a Republican thing can come back. What's your sort of projection if we continue without an ambitious project like you're describing?
I mean, you know, it's dangerous to project the future, but I think that we're seeing with this pandemic, right, a difficulty like responding to things that don't totally slot into everybody's ideological priors, right? Nobody's like favorite policy idea is like, let's deal with a pandemic, right? Like everybody has their projects and they have their obsessions and they have their kind of hangups, but like shit happens sometimes, right? And what we're seeing is like a total inability to just like put the stuff down for a minute and like work on a problem, right? And, you know, I'm embedded in a more progressive universe in which, you know, people have their critiques of Trump in that regard. I think he's made a bunch of really serious errors here. But the biggest error he made is not trying to shift gears into a less partisan framework. And it's simply encouraged Democrats to treat it as yet another partisan issue, right? And, you know, successful leaders normally in moments of national crisis try to diffuse that and try to say, look, like, we have two parties for a reason. Like, there are important disagreements here, but like, actually, we don't disagree. Like, should old people just die in nursing homes, right? Like, that's not what the partisan divide is about. So maybe we can unify here. But we're moving in a direction of just increasing inability to cope with anything because it serves political entrepreneurs' interests to just like, we can fight about the Oscars all day, right? Like they can tweak the nomination scheme to be more diverse. And then Republicans can complain that the tweaking was bad and Mulan and Xinjiang and who's hypocritical. And like, we could just like verbal people, like I think us and everybody in the public, we're like really good at that, right? Like we can really spot the hypocrites and we can call them out, you know, and like get some little hearts on our tweets. But nothing changes that way, right? It's not constructive. And, you know, so I don't know what specifically happens if we keep doing that, but we're living through it, right? We're living through, like, California is on fire and Ted Cruz is dunking on them. But liberals are like, the problem is climate change, right? And, like, climate change is a problem. California's electricity grid is a problem. But also, like, I read this great article in ProPublica, and it was about, like, the technical aspects of fire management. And so, like, one big reason they're having this fire problem is they're not handling the technical aspects of fire management correctly, which is exactly what you would think. But it's, like, impossible to get the political system to focus on that, right? Like, the problem is the fire, right? Like, we got to do something about that. Right. The CEO of Stripe, he tweeted, Patrick, Patrick Collison, he's like, what are some ideas about firefighting? And like, everybody got so mad at him. He's like, you're not supposed to talk about firefighting in the middle of a fire. And it's like, I don't know, man, like that's not great. Like we have to be able to talk about the actual things that are happening and not just what happened to be our personal political obsessions.
So our last sort of section here, because we should have hit it earlier, you sort of sum up the opposition to your program from sort of the left and the right is basically coming down to the country is full. And the most obvious sort of, and we sort of talked about the rights argument, right? The country is culturally full. You know, there are working class like issues there with like workers. But from the left, it's basically climate change and the environment. And that was actually a really interesting section of your book. So can you sort of like, let's just talk about that, right? So like, why? I mean, I know I come from like Portland, Oregon. So like, I very much come from like the milieu of like, don't have kids because it's going to destroy the climate. You're obviously arguing against that notion here.
Yeah, so, you know, so there's an environmental movement in the United States, which has its origins in a kind of neo-pastoralist sentiment, right? Yeah. And the kind of basic original environmentalist idea is like, you should go live on a farm in Vermont and you should compost. And coming out of that movement, we have a lot of actually important scientific insights, right? And so it turns out, right, that like lead is very harmful to human brain development. We've learned more that particulate pollution has all kinds of ill health impacts. It also turns out that carbon dioxide emissions are creating a layer of greenhouse gases in the world, and it's raising temperatures, and there are problems associated with that, you know, ice caps melting, shifting weather patterns. But the original neo-pastoralist vision does not address that problem in any kind of realistic way, right? When you think about like what the climate science actually says, right, like it's not, it's really bad, but it's not so bad that people in the developed world are just going to give up on their aspiration to like have electricity, right? Right? Yeah. No, but it's oftentimes like the answer amounts to it. It's like, well, okay, if we just conserve more and also get other people who are using almost no energy to like also conserve more, then it's going to all work out. But that's not going to work. Like they are going to use more energy, right? And the biggest climate problem for 1 billion Americans is that, like, if people come here, if you come here from Nigeria, you just like get way richer. And so you use more energy, and our energy creates pollution. So that's a real issue. But just saying like, just stay poor, man, just chill out. Like, right, that's not a real solution. So if you want to think about real solutions to climate change, like, we've got to take stuff. We have technologies that work, right? Electric cars work, solar power works, windmills work, nuclear and hydro kind of work. Then we've got to deploy those technologies. But we also have to develop other technologies, right? So there's like promising stuff about nuclear microreactors. Maybe that'll work, maybe it won't work. We got to try to make it work, right? There's other things where so far we're like nowhere. Like, how do you make concrete and steel without crazy emissions? Nobody fucking knows, right? So you got to work on solving that problem. Now, in the United States, there's things we can do. I think like we should try to build our new buildings out of cross-laminated timber rather than as much rebar. You know, that's a good idea. It's this great Vox article about it. At the same time, like, you still got to like giant civil engineering projects like need concrete, right? So we need to like work on that. It's a difficult technical problem. You need R&D, you know, all that normal stuff that people say when they're in their like Green New Deal mode. But that's very different from we're moving to the farm and we're going to do composting, right? And population is irrelevant. Like, if we can have these incredible technological breakthroughs that make it possible to have a prosperous, dynamic society in a more ecologically sustainable way, then like, it's great. We could have 100 billion Americans. We could have colonies on Mars, you know, like the sky's the limit, right? And that's the framing that I want to have. I want people to address the climate problem in a, you know, eco-modernist perspective, right? Rather than a neo-pastoralist perspective. And I think when you adopt the modernist perspective, you're taking the problem seriously. It doesn't mean like do nothing and say technology is the answer. It means like focus on technology, but population control is definitely not the answer.
Yeah. You know, one thing that really strikes me about this is it's almost like a technocratic populism. It's like, we need to approach this through like technocracy. We need like an awesome technocracy, which is able of doing this and carrying this out through a billion Americans. Have you thought about the mechanisms of actually assembling like a great technocracy? I've thought a lot about how do you create like good personnel in order to carry through these, like, I think I heard you talking somewhere about, it was like in Sweden, they have transit authorities who are just like very pleasant and like will help you. And you could just never imagine an MTA worker like doing that for you in New York City. How do you do that? And because that seems to me the key to actually fulfilling and carrying through so much of what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a sort of rank and file, you know, civil service aspect to it. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in this. I think it is worth noting, right, in America, this is absolutely the technocratic populist synthesis, right? It's like, look at the Navy, right? Like, they've got these giant ships with nuclear reactors on them that airplanes land on. Yeah. And they're all staffed by government employees, right? Like, but it's not like going to the DMV, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, those guys are awesome, right? And part of it, you know, is like, yes, like, they are paid and, you know, it's important. But also, like, it's respected. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, we take it seriously. They're held to a high standard. Like, you can get drummed out of the service, but you can also earn a lot of prestige. Right. It's like, you know, like if the generals say something, like, people take it seriously. Right. And it's like, it's maybe a problem for Trump if the generals don't like him. And, you know, there's complexities around being so, like, all in on the military, because it's a very specific social function with its own.
Right.
Interests, but I think it's a proof of concept, right? That, like, you can have prestigious, dynamic public sector entities, but part of that is buy-in, right? Like, one reason why the military has that allure is that Republicans have traditionally believed that the military function is important, right? So I'll really get myself in trouble and talk about police, right? Where it's not going to achieve what progressives want, to create a situation where Democrats are just, like, dumping on, like, the concept of the cops all mm-hmm. the time. And it becomes, like, a really stigmatized thing to go into if you're a liberal, right? It's like, you want, I think, sensible people on the left, like, they want the policing to be different and they want it to be better.
Yeah.
But, like, you're still going to want, like, you're going to want good people, maybe even better people, to, like, want to go into it. And that means you have to have a rhetoric that, like, embraces the idea that wanting to be a police officer is a completely reasonable thing to do with your life. In fact, like, an honorable thing to do with your life. Right now, you know, Democrats would probably say that about, like, working at the EPA, right? Being
yes,
a scientist right. there. But Republicans definitely wouldn't. Right.
Yeah.
They'll be like,
yeah. No, you're right.
Like, oh, you're wasting your life, you know, or you're in the deep state. And, you know, for some agencies, like, that's fine. It can be partisan. But for things that are important for them to function well, you need some kind of buy-in that it's like, yes, like, this is a legitimate public function. We want people teaching our children. We want people patrolling our streets. We want people sailing around in the ocean, right? And, like, it's good. Good for you. Like, let's clap. Let's hold you to a standard. Let's reward you if you do your job well. You know, and it's hard, right? But that's part of some level of consensus, right? Even while you might have disagreement about, like, what exactly should we be doing here, if you have some kind of agreement that, like, look, it's important to not have the air choked with pollution, like, then you can have a culture of respect for the people whose job it is to do that. And it's bad when you see that breaking down, which, unfortunately, I think we do of more and more sectors of life.
Matt, thank you so much. This is really great. Really recommend the book, and congratulations and good luck with the COVID era book tour. I know it's really tough.
Yeah, one thing before we go, is there anywhere you want to direct people to buy the book or a newsletter or anything?
So I've got a website for the book, 1billionamericans.com, a great place to check it out. You know, Buy at your local independent bookstore if you feel sentimental. Get the Kindle edition if you don't. I do the read of the audiobook if you like listening to my voice even more. So yeah, just buy it any way you can. That's my bottom line awesome. Message.
All right, man. Well, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. As always, drop us a 5-star review, leave us a question in the comments, or take a screenshot of that review and your question and send it to us at realignmentpod@gmail.com.
That's right. And thanks, as always, to the Lincoln Network for being the host of this podcast. We appreciate their sponsorship very much. And on Thursday, we are going to have Crystal Ball from Rising. Make sure you guys subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Realignment, so you can watch that full discussion. And with that, see you guys in a few days.